I'm glad to see that Surat has at last been put in his proper place, behind bars. Namo Buddhaya. So we come to that great question, what is beauty? And immediately what came to my mind in addressing this question was a poem that Bhante puts at the beginning of The Eternal Legacy. It's an extract from Kit Marlowe's Tamburlaine, which itself is a remarkable work. It's a very, very poor piece of theatre, as it were, but it's an extraordinary piece of poetry. But Bhante clearly quotes this because it expresses something that is very important to him. So I'll do my best with Elizabethan English. What is beauty, saith my sufferings then? Yes, Tamburlaine has just lost his wife. She's just died as Anocrate, and he's completely distraught. He's just a mighty warrior, but here you hear a different voice from him. What is beauty, saith my sufferings then? If all the pens that ever poets held had fed the feeling of their master's thoughts, and every sweetness that inspired their hearts, their minds, and muses on admired themes, if all the heavenly quintessence they still from their immortal flowers of poesy, wherein, as in a mirror, we perceive the highest reaches of a human wit, if these had made one poem's period, and all combined in beauty's worthiness, yet should there hover in their restless heads one thought, one grace, one wonder at the least, which into words no virtue can digest. Beauty is incomprehensible. It's beyond the reach of reason. Beauty cannot be fully expressed. You could say that this is one of its primary characteristics, that beauty is not to be thought about. Beauty is to be felt directly. It's non-conceptual. Just over the last weeks, I've been looking into Kant's philosophy, and especially his aesthetics. And some of you probably know a little about Kant, or probably some of you even know a lot. But of course, he's the great figure in Western philosophy who's really made Buddhism possible. Without Kant, I think we couldn't really be Buddhists today. He turned Western thought on its head. The Copernican Revolution in philosophy, as he called it. But his philosophy, first of all, attempted to establish the grounds for scientific theory, for reasoned scientific theory. Then he tried to establish the grounds for morality. And then he tried to establish the grounds for aesthetic judgment, the judgment of beauty and of the sublime. And he regarded this as pivotal. The judgment of beauty was the pivotal one because it was direct. It didn't require the use of conceptual reason, so that it gave you access to the heights, the depths that reason, in his language, implied. It gave you access to it absolutely directly. So beauty is extremely important because it's immediate, it's felt, it's intuited. In the strict sense, intuited meaning that you don't think about it, you feel it. Beauty is intensely pleasurable. To experience beauty is to experience pleasure, it's experience delight. Even if the object is not something necessarily especially pleasant, if you see what I mean. You know, like the end of Hamlet with a stage littered with bodies, is not, in a certain sense, pleasant. But the artistry of it, the beauty of the dramatic unfoldment is intensely pleasing. So pleasure of beauty, the pleasure of beauty is not necessarily pleasure about the subject of beauty, if you see what I mean. So yes, beauty is intensely engaging because it's pleasing to one, and it therefore evokes a strong response, which we're calling an erotic response, a strong response of immediate engagement, of delight. It's extremely important, this element in beauty, that it grabs you by the pleasure nerves, so to speak. It engages you because it's fulfilling, because it's fascinating, because it's uplifting, because it's inspiring. And the third characteristic of beauty that I think we can draw out for the time being is that it has an inevitable tendency to transcendence. We're going to go into this much more tomorrow when we look at Bante's Platonism. But the basic point is that when you view anything that is pleasurable, that is beautiful, it evokes a response of pleasure, but it engages you, and then the object itself becomes inadequate as an expression of the beauty, if you see what I mean. So that you pass from that object to a deeper contemplation of beauty, if you know how to, if you allow yourself to do so. But again, a bit like you watch a really good film, and you may think a little bit about the contents of the film, but afterwards you're left with a definite, let's say, feeling, a definite contemplation. And that contemplation goes way beyond the subject matter of the film and even the experience of it. Same with any work of art. So these three characteristics of beauty are extremely important from the point of view of our exploration here. Beauty is non-conceptual. It is intensely pleasurable and therefore engaging. And it is... what was the last one? It has a tendency to transcend itself. It sort of draws you beyond its object. And why this is important, we'll see this once Padmavajra gets going, that we can draw upon these qualities of beauty, these aspects of beauty, in our meditation. Padmavajra told me that he mentioned or asked Paramartha, does Bante know what we're doing? Does he know we're doing something on Bante's hidden teachings, Eros and beauty? And apparently he said yes, that Bante does know. And his only comment was, beauty is very important. Am I quoting correctly?
Beauty. He said it twice.
Beauty is very important. Beauty is very important. So presumably that means he thinks it's very important. In fact, it means he thinks it's very important. And when you start looking at his writing, his work, even if it's not always talked of in terms of beauty, it's clearly something that he thinks is central to his perspective on the Dhamma life. I think for those reasons that I've already given, those three factors that I've already given. In fact, so important does Bante consider beauty to be that he considers it needs to be drawn out more fully and given a stronger and clearer place in the Buddhist exposition. And this is one of those teachings of Bante's that is justifiable fully in traditional terms, but that won't be found absolutely in those terms in tradition, a bit like the five niyamas and so on, the going for refuge. But in this case, Bante says that he thinks that you can think of a fourth vimoksha mukha, which would be shubha. So just to fill you all in, I'm sure everybody's at least glancingly familiar with this, but just to fill us all in, you remember there are three lakshanas and four viparyasas. There's anicca, anatman, and dukkha. And when you come to the viparyasas, you add to that asubha, unbeautiful, ugly. But when you the vimoksha mukhas are the, as it were, positive transcendental counterparts of the lakshanas. And Bhante again has stressed, in a way that I've never seen done anywhere else, that when you're contemplating the lakshanas, you should always contemplate the vimokshamukha that corresponds. So if you're contemplating anicchata, you should contemplate animitta. When you're contemplating anatman, you should contemplate shunyata. When you're contemplating dukkha, you should contemplate apranihita. He says that if you don't do that, the danger is that you fall into a nihilism. You fall into thinking that everything's impermanent. Oh dear, let's have fun while it lasts. Or that there is no real substantial self or substance of any kind. So, what the hell? Let's get on with it. And yes, if you contemplate dukkha, that if anything is grasped, it will lead to suffering. It just seems as if you're saying, we're doomed. So you need to contemplate the two side by side. And he said that the real contemplation of the lakshanas consists in trying to see the relationship in experience between the lakshana and the vimokshamukha. So, you know, the vimokshamukha that corresponds to anicchata, to impermanence, is animitta. Which is usually translated as the signless, which is really recognizing that there are no fixed boundaries between things. There's no, you know, we use a word to denominate something, but that word is simply our conceptual construction, that the thing itself isn't contained by that term. And the correspondence between anatman and shunyata is that anatma means that, yes, there is no fixed metaphysical self, no permanent self-identity in a fixed sense. The corresponding vimokshamukha there is shunyata, which is not emptiness in the narrow sense, but the complete openness of reality, reality without boundary, reality without constriction. And the correspondence between dukkha and apranihita, arises because we crave. When we stop craving, we experience a wonderful state of freedom, a wonderful state of release. I always quote as an example of what this means. So going around IKEA with Sanghadeva. I was walking around IKEA one day with Sanghadeva because I had to do some shopping to buy some furniture for my new place. And he was just there to help me in his usual extremely helpful manner. And as we were walking around, seeing all these absolutely determined Brummies out on their shopping expeditions, and there's nothing more terrifying, and we were walking in the opposite direction to the flow. Old habits die hard. And I noticed that Sanghadeva was grinning like a bit of an idiot. He was just sort of a big smile on his face as he's walking around. So I assumed he'd seen the perfect armchair or something like that. And so I turned to him and said, you know, what's going on? He said, I'm really happy. There's nothing here I want. That is the apranihita. On another scale, of course. Off the scale. These are the three lakshanas with the three vimokshamukhas. But with the viparyasas, you pair the shubha and the ashubha. Being the recognition of the relative lack of beauty of things. Bhante wants us to put it that way rather than the ugliness. In a sense, he's arguing that everything does express a sort of an ultimate beauty, but it's easier or less easy to approach it in particular forms, if you see what I mean. Some forms bring one closer to that ideal beauty than others do. Others repel and are associated with other kinds of aversive feeling. But yes, the asubha means the relative lack of attractiveness, you could put it, of much within conditioned reality. Bhante argues that we can think of the subha that corresponds to the asubha, or shubha that corresponds to the ashubha, Sanskrit Pali Sanskrit, as a vimokshamukha. So the vimokshamukha, the gateway to liberation, is a contemplation, a source of contemplation that can lead into a real experience of liberation. So he's saying that as much as contemplating the lakshanas, conventionally expressed or traditionally expressed, and their vimokshamukhas, we could contemplate especially shubha. And I would argue that there's something about shubha that is more compelling and more direct than the other lakshanas. Of course, to some extent, it depends on individuals, it depends on circumstances. It can be that shunyata has been brought very much to life for you and become something really beautiful. It could be that the ultimate unspeakability of reality has been made into something really alive for you and that you can strongly engage with. It may be that the idea of being completely free from all craving, even for IKEA objects, has become for you a living experience. But Bhante's arguing that with beauty, there's a more direct route through your more mundane experience of beauty, if you see what I mean, because of this hierarchical experience of beauty. Beauty exists on different levels. And if you can get hold of the tale of beauty, as it were, on one level, it traces itself through to higher levels. So this really is the foundation of what we're hoping to do in the afternoons, and that Pamavajra is going to be your guide to. How we use our meditation practices to engage with the, let's call it, lakshana and vimokshamukha of asubha and subha. We're not going to bother too much about the asubha. That will take care of itself. We're going to be seeking the beautiful. And a lot of what we're going to be implying over the next few days is how we individually find where the subha lies before us. What it is that engages us with beauty, and that can be, even starting from a relatively mundane point of view, can be a sort of gateway into liberation of vimokshamukha. And this is what, of course, Plato taught via Socrates in the so-called Socratic phase of Plato's dialogues. I don't really have much more to say. I wanted just to set the scene for what Pamavajra is going to say, and just to stress these three major elements in beauty that are both so engaging, make it such a compelling basis for Dhamma life, and that we can also use as parts of our contemplation. It's inexpressibility, no virtue can distill. It can't be caught in words. Yet should there hover in their restless heads something that cannot be expressed, in Marlowe's words. Then it's It's intense pleasure. Thank you. It's strongly engaging quality. And a lot of what I hope we're going to be looking at over these days is where our own engagement is. Where is our eros, or eros is expressed through us, engaging with beauty in our own direct experience? Not necessarily in lofty ideas or the greatest of art or anything like that. Where does it start? Where is what really gets our juices flowing? And then how do we move on to the third, which is through that, allow it to transcend itself. So we don't just get caught up. We get caught up when we try to acquire the source of beauty and try to make it part of our identity. But how do we take that immediate connection with beauty and allow it to unfold? This, I think, is our major task during these days, to not place beauty so high that we just gasp and wonder at it and forget it, but to bring it down into our immediate experience. This is the whole basis of Plato's theory of the ascent of beauty, and then use it to go higher and higher. And as I say, I think this is one of those aspects of Bhante's teaching that could be forgiven for not really having caught up until now. It was very much alive in the early days of Bhante's teaching. I'm sure some of you are well aware of it. And Bhante himself is such a lover of beauty, and so passionate about it in his own particular way, that it was inescapable for us. And he created an environment within which that was very much, much alive. And I think it'd be a real disservice if we didn't make that central to our presentation, so that we caught that flavour. Not that other things are excluded. The other lakshanas are worthy of being contemplated, and they will be effective as contemplations when they are beautiful. When we see the vimokshamukhas associated with them as beautiful, engaging, emotionally engaging, erotically engaging. So it's now up to Pamavadra to tell us how to do this. You know, I'm very good at the theory. I've no idea how to do it. That's Pamavadra's job, to bring it to life. But I hope you've got at least some idea of this very important connection between beauty and insight. Is the buzzword of the moment, isn't it? We all want to get insight. Well, you can get it through beauty. Of course, beauty understood in the context of the other lakshanas. Beauty really understood. One of Bhante's criticisms, or rather his reservations about Platonism, is that Plato, of course, had a metaphysical doctrine of forms, which is sort of quasi-eternalist, as it were. There are different ways of interpreting it, but Bhante dissociates himself from that metaphysical aspect of Plato's teaching. He identifies very strongly with the element of the ascent through beauty, and he considers this to be a key to the transmission of the Dhamma in the West. So let's find out how to do it.